Hi, everybody. Welcome to New Books in African American Studies. This is Sean Hamilton, your host. Today, our guest is Joshua Bloom. He's the co-author of Black Against Empire. Josh, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fine, Sean. Thank you for having me on.
Great. Thanks for coming on. Welcome. I guess let's first start out. Just tell me a little bit about yourself and your background.
Well, I was an organizer for a number of years and actually met some of the former Panther leaders doing organizing work, and then returned to school. And some of the questions that came out of that work in the field, it really seemed like getting into the history of the Black Panther Party and understanding how that politics really took hold and developed and spread was a way of trying to get at some of the broader questions about movement building that I was interested in from the organizing work. And, you know, I was really shocked that the history hadn't been seriously analyzed and that people hadn't had a chance to really make sense of that shift. So I built on those relationships and got into this project.
Okay. And tell us about the title, Black Against Empire. How'd you come up with that?
Well, what is really striking and really sets up the project is the contrast with the civil rights movement. And this is a moment in the mid-60s when the civil rights movement is starting to falter and has really reached some great impacts and some real transformations of society, and yet is it's not really clear how it can move forward. And the Black Panther Party really emerges in the late 60s as a very different kind of politics, and it's different in a number of ways, but key to that is how it presents itself and thinks about what its project is. And there's a key piece of that is an anti-imperialism. The Black Panther Party really presents itself as a legitimate representative of the black community, and this, you know, it's a very nationalist project in that sense, and saying, you know, we as the black community are a community, and we have our own interests and our own needs and should be able to represent ourselves. And that very much is building on Malcolm X and a lot of the social programs and the 10-point program are very much in the spirit of Malcolm X's vision of the black community, really as its own steward, and the Black Panther Party asserting itself as sort of an instrument, a vehicle of that, and very much posing that politics in opposition to empire, in opposition to U.S. empire. Very much the Vietnam War is an important piece of the political context and the draft, and anti-colonial struggles in Africa as well, some that have been successful, others that are ongoing, and throughout Asia, and as well as Latin America, and the, you know, the Panthers build strong alliances with the Cubans and the Algerians and the North Koreans and the Chinese, and as well as the North Vietnamese and the Liberation Front, South Vietnam, and really see themselves as part of this global struggle against imperialism, and put forward their own politics as really, you know, a black community politics as part of this global resistance to imperial power. Yeah. So that's where the title comes from, Black Against Empire. It really captures those key elements of the party's own self-understanding and presentation as a representative of the black community as part of a global struggle against American imperialism.
Good. Now, Huey Newton and Bobby Seale, in the beginning of your book, or just knowing a little bit about their backgrounds, don't in their early lives seem like the ideal people to jump into, you know, a struggle like that. Tell me a little bit about their early years, and also the political climate in Oakland. That just doesn't seem like the place where something like this would start, right?
So Bobby and Huey and Oakland, I mean, I think, you know, there's lots of people in this moment who are asking a similar set of questions. This is, you know, really a Black Power moment, right? You think about 1966 and, you know, Stokely Carmichael and Willie Ricks coming out of SNCC and, you know, proclaiming Black Power and really giving voice to what lots and lots of young people, both in the movement but in cities throughout the North and the West, who are really coming up and, you know, inspired by the civil rights victories on the one hand, but really have not had their issues addressed on the other. And, you know, the civil rights movement was very effective at dismantling Jim Crow, but it didn't make inroads into poverty. It didn't make inroads into ghettoization. It didn't make inroads really into political exclusion. It didn't make inroads into access into higher education or hiring by municipalities. You know, you look at the police departments and the fire departments and the, you know, cities with the large Black populations in that moment in the late, you know, mid to late 1960s, and they're all white. And very few, six congressmen nationally, Black congressmen nationally, and no real change on that through the civil rights, really, the years of the peak civil rights protests in the early 60s. So there's lots of young Black people saying, how are we going to address these situations that have not been addressed with the dismantling of Jim Crow? And there's the Black Congress in L.A., but these kinds of discussions are going on in Oakland, they're going on in New York, they're going on in Chicago, they're really going on across the country. And Black Power has been taken up in late 1966 as sort of the framing of that question. What do we need? We need Black Power. We need political power. We need economic power. We need a way to address our ghettoization, our poverty, our political exclusion. But how do you do that? And so there's lots of people who are asking this question, and Bobby Seale and Huey Newton are among them, and both of them had been active through the 60s. They actually met in 1962 at a protest of the embargo of Cuba, and had been involved in a whole variety of organizations in Oakland. The two of them had slightly different sort of paths through that, but they had each worked with different groups affiliated with the Revolutionary Action Movement. They both worked with Donald Worden, and he had moved more towards sort of a Black capitalism kind of framework, but had really introduced both of them to a lot of the readings about Black history and Black politics that were very formative for both of them, you know, including works like Fanon, you know, Franz Fanon's Wretched of the Earth, and you know, Franklin Frazier, and I don't remember whether Donald Worden introduced them to Mao and to Che as well, but they had done a lot of that reading, I think, on their own outside of Worden. But he introduced them to a lot of the crucial pieces that they had read early on, and you know, they had done a lot of their early organizing with him. And they were very different individuals. Bobby was about 5 years older. Bobby Seale was about 5 years older, and he had gone through and had been in the military and had worked on a Gemini missile program, and was very much an organization guy and make things sort of happen in a very practical way kind of guy, and also this great speaker. He could really, you know, he did some stand-up comedy earlier on, and he could really hold an audience and draw people in, and So he had both those strengths. He could build organization, and he could, you know, had just a great mind for practical detail and really making things work. And he also was great at speaking, at public speaking. And Huey Newton had a different set of strengths. And he was a much more theoretical sort of leader. He sat down and stepped back and broke apart sort of the philosophical kind of approach almost to how to think about what the situation was and how to see what the bigger picture was and step outside the box. So he had this, you look at the formation of the parties sort of thinking early on, and Huey Newton writes this whole series of essays, both leading up to and then in the transformation of the party, that really helped to reshape and form what's distinctive about the politics of Black Panther Party. But he also had this other piece, which was that he could read the moment in these intense confrontations. So one of the things that Huey did early on was he came up with this strategy of policing the police. And it was building on what was being done by the Community Alert Patrol in Los Angeles, where, you know, the Watts rebellions largely in response to an incident of police brutality, and a group organized itself, the Community Alert Patrol, and they started following the police around with tape recorders and notepads and saying, you know, we're not going to let the police brutalize our community. How are we going to get Black power? We're going to get Black power in part by making sure that we're no longer brutalized by the police. And this was a big issue in cities throughout the country at that point, because you had had white flight, you had had the jobs leaving the cities, you had had large Black populations that had been mostly drawn through wartime employment, but those jobs had left, and so you had this containment policing, and a lot of the anger really was building up in relation to this containment policing, because the municipalities were responding to poverty by basically keeping people contained through brutality. And so you had lots of young Blacks being killed during this period by the police, lots of beatings, and very little accountability. And so the Community Alert Patrol was an organization that had begun it. They were thinking very much, you know, I mean, in 65 when they started to get organized, they weren't thinking in terms of the word Black Power, but it was part of that shift, and they were, you know, they became sort of one of these Black Power organizations. And what Huey Newton saw was, you know, there were limits in how far Community Alert Patrol could go, because they would, you know, try to patrol the police, but there was no accountability, and there were some incidents where the police actually reportedly beat up and took the cameras and broke the, you know, tape recorders for the Community Alert Patrol. And so there was an inability to really hold them accountable. And one of the things that Huey Newton was really captivated by was Robert Williams' vision and actions in the South of armed self-defense. And, Negroes. Guns. That was also an important inspiration for Newton. And so what Huey Newton did is he studied the law, and he thought about sort of how do we capture that power of armed self-defense? How do we stand up to the police? And he created these armed patrols that were these legal patrols, where he knew the distance you could stand. He knew that you couldn't have the guns loaded in the car, that felons couldn't carry handguns. There were all these very specific regulations, but that it was legal to carry guns loaded in the municipalities within certain constraints, and how far you have to stand from police. So within the letter of the law, he then was able to create these legally armed patrols, where he and Bobby Seale and a couple other followers in the beginning were able to actually follow the police around, and when they pulled somebody over, they would stand there, you know, at a legal distance with these arms, monitoring the police. And This was really where the party started to take off and started to distinguish itself from these other Black Power organizations, because it wasn't any longer just sort of presenting a position or a philosophy, but it was actually providing a practice and a means by which people could do something about their condition, specifically challenging this widespread police brutality. And what was, you know, to bring this back to Huey Newton, he had sort of both parts of that. It wasn't the public speaking and the organizational capacity that Bobby brought. What it was he had both that sort of theoretical capacity to stand back and look at the bigger picture and then study the gun law and come up with this tactic of patrolling the police, but he also could implement it. And, you know, you think about in that context of the you know, this is 66, 67, really, when these patrols really take off in Oakland. And there's this whole series of armed confrontations with the police that Huey Newton orchestrates, and they get very heated. I mean, you know, they actually, none of them come to shots, but they come close in a variety of circumstances. And Huey Newton was someone who could really read the dynamics, and he could, you know, see how and how far to push. And, you know, they always took the position that they would take an arrest, but, you know, then they would take the police to court for false arrest, because they were very, you know, particular and meticulous about staying within the letter of the law. And so Huey Newton was someone who not only sort of came up with this kind of tactic and strategy, as well as a whole series of other strategic innovations as the party developed, but was someone who, in practice, in the heat of the moment, could really implement that with, you know, not just courage, but with precision and integrity in a way that was very powerful and important in the founding of the party. In terms of Oakland, I think, you know, Oakland in many ways was much like many other cities, and part of the reason that Oakland was so important was just because so many other cities did have some similar conditions. You had a large Black population that had been drawn by wartime employment. A lot of the jobs had fallen apart. There was brutal policing, containment policing. That there had been no participation in any significant level in local governance, very little participation in the police department, municipal hiring. And another important thing that, you know, I think, you know, sometimes overlooked, but I think is important to Oakland too, and was actually important in many of the, not all, but a large majority of the cities where there were large Black Panther chapters, is that there was a big university there, and in Berkeley, right next door. And a lot of the alliance politics and the anti-imperialist politics and the development of the theoretical framework, as well as the specific work that Huey Newton did with Donald Warden and then with the group from Revolutionary Action Movement, Ernie Allen and those other folks, was all tied through the Berkeley campus. And those relationships and the relationship with Ramparts Magazine and with the Peace and Freedom Party and many of the early and important allies, it was crucial to have that tie to the activism that was developing on the University of California campus as well. Those are sort of some of the ways that the characters of Huey Newton and Bobby Seale and some of their backgrounds and Oakland helped to contribute to the development of the party in Oakland.
Okay. And now, how did they distinguish themselves from some of the other groups that were coming about? I know there was U.S. was one of them. I think that was also active in Oakland. What made them unique? I know there was a little bit of a conflict between, was it cultural nationalism and Black nationalism, and, you know, other sort of ideologies.
Yeah, well, let me distinguish. I mean, I think that there's different kinds of differences with different groups. There was such a range of groups that emerged in that period. The Black Panther Party very much emerged as the, by 68, 69, 70, it really was the main movement organization that really was, you know, organizing on a significant scale in insurgent politics. But in that earlier period, 66 into 67, there were, you know, many organizations of comparable scale So a few important contrasts would be with SNCC, with the US organization, and with the Revolutionary Action Movement. I think if you think about SNCC, SNCC was really a lead organization in the civil rights movement, and it had had tremendous success in mobilizing very, very effectively and powerfully nonviolent civil disobedience, which really dismantled formal caste subordination in this country. And there were a number of other organizations. You know, top on the list, in addition to SNCC, would be CORE, that, and then, of course, King's SCLC, that mobilized also a lot of the nonviolent direct action. But SNCC was probably the organization that organized the most of that. And the challenge was that SNCC, you know, had a politics that was really oriented towards an effective at challenging Jim Crow. And so by 66, 67, it was really in a crisis trying to reinvent itself. And it never really did, you know. So, I mean, I think that would be, sort of a very stark difference there, right, is that SNCC was trying to figure out what it meant to be a Black Power organization, and it had some stature that it had built in the period of the challenge to civil rights, and it tried to carry over a lot of the institutional forms and some of the ideas. And then there were, you know, a whole variety of ideas in different camps within SNCC that ended up actually tearing the organization apart. But it never really found an answer to how to challenge ghettoization or build political power or economic power outside of the nonviolent civil disobedient challenge to Jim Crow and claims for incorporation in America and citizenship rights and participation in America. Never was able to really transcend that politics and come up with a cohesive and effective new program. If you contrast the Black Panther Party with an organization like RAM, the Revolutionary Action Movement, RAM in many ways was very, very similar. I mean, the party drew on RAM in developing a lot of their theoretical framework and their anti-imperialism and revolutionary Black nationalism. What RAM didn't do is it never was able to, on any large scale, translate those ideas into practice in a way that built a significant following. And the Black Panthers called, you know, they worked and drew from RAM in the early days, but then really moved beyond those sort of theoretical roots and developed a whole series of practices in an organization and a following. And they basically called RAM armchair revolutionaries because, you know, they talked about revolution but didn't have any significant following or constituency and never were really able to find a practical basis for how to mobilize people. And that's what really distinguished the Black Panther Party was building a practical politics that really moved people and it built upon the kind of framework a little bit different from but building within generally the same kind of revolutionary nationalist framework as RAM to a practical politics that really moved quite a large number of people across the country. The US organization, Ron Karenga worked in the early days also with Donald Warden. I don't think there was a US organization at that time in Oakland. He went to LA. I think in the early 60s. I don't remember what year he went to LA, but certainly by 66, 67 he was in LA, and I think it was a few years earlier than that. So I don't know how much interaction the early Panthers had in Oakland with him until they started to become, you know, more of a national organization. There were interactions certainly, by February of 68 in Los Angeles. But in terms of the differences with the organization, the US organization was, as you said, it was a cultural nationalist organization, and so the position was that, you know, roughly, that the way that Black power could be built was that Black people needed to really tap into their cultural roots and create a powerful, sort of distinct, independent national culture. And so Ron Correga advanced some ideas which have really taken, you know, hold. So you look at an idea like Kwanzaa. That's an idea that was created by Ron Correga. And, you know, Kwanzaa, you know, has become, you can go into any, you know, any, you know, store that sells holiday cards, and you can buy a Hallmark Kwanzaa card. And that's, you know, that's part of sort of a broader culture at this point. But there was not the idea that, that sort of a movement needed to be advanced, which was a revolutionary challenge to America as an empire. And in fact, the political actions, oftentimes, within US organization, the idea was that you could work politically within the political system as it was structured, and that where the real sort of nation building would happen would be in this sort of, in these cultural terms. And so the Black Panther Party took very serious issue with that and argued that, you know, no, this is an imperialist state, and that participation in, you know, the capitalist economy and America as it's constituted politically doesn't leave space for Black people to build economic and political power, and that, you know, if Black people want to build political and economic power, it needs to be done through the creation of a political challenge and a challenge to American imperial power. And so that was a real sort of basic theoretical and political difference, and it shaped the actions. The US organization did do in Southern California in the early days. It did do some extensive organizing, and what was interesting was it became targeted in those early days fairly heavily as well by the federal COINTELPRO and repressive action by the state, and US organization pretty quickly scaled back from doing any extensive organizing and really dropped off that real organizing piece and saw itself more as, you know, if you read Scott Brown's, has the definitive history of the US organization. I'm certainly no expert, but he talks about the organization really seeing itself as a cultural vanguard operating on a small level to create a sort of cultural model that others could take up and that would spread. But it never really did broad-scale political organizing after its early days, and really focused on much more this sort of cultural development rather than building a broader political challenge.
Talk a little bit about the spread of the Black Panther Party from Oakland to, you know, other 68 cities, I think, at one point, right?
To 68 cities, yeah. Well, there were so many people who were asking, how do you build Black power? What is it, you know, how are we going to be able to stand up to the police? How are we going to be able to challenge poverty? How are we going to, you know, challenge ghettoization? How are we going to build political representation and economic power? And so there were a lot of people asking this question, and the party really emerged. You know, it started to emerge as an answer on a local level with these armed patrols of the police, and there were several phases through which it sort of it built broader and broader following, and then really extended to quite significant influence nationally and to some extent internationally. And so just, you know, to touch briefly on a few of those shifts, One piece was that, when they were doing the armed patrols in Oakland, it was still a pretty small organization. Maybe there were a dozen Panthers initially, but what happened was that a young black man named Denzel Dow was killed by the police, shot in the back, and the parents and a lot of the community in North Richmond, this area, unincorporated area north of Oakland, really thought that the police had basically just murdered. A lot of people thought that they had basically murdered Denzel Dow. And he had a limp, he was unarmed, and there had been a history between the particular officer that shot him. And so they went, there was no local police department, there was a county sheriff because it was this unincorporated area. And the parents and some of the other community members had gone to the sheriff and just had basically been blown off and ignored. And the local civil rights organizations, none of them really had any significant response. And so a guy named Mark Comfort, who had done some organizing in Oakland and was knew the family, took this to Bobby Seale and Huey Newton, and I think they may have had some experience earlier in North Richmond as well, but Mark Comfort brought this particular issue to them, and so they went and got involved, and it really changed the dynamics, because when you had these small armed patrols of the police in Oakland, it had been a few individuals, and there had been some there was a confrontation at the airport and one at Ramparts Magazine and one in front of Merritt that had sort of large audiences and had sort of drawn some attention and some local press coverage and these kinds of things, but it was a pretty small sort of scale of mobilization. But when you get Denzel Dow being killed and the Panthers step in and they go and they organize a delegation to go confront the sheriff, and then they do some organizing at the local school, and then they organize a street rally, and you get hundreds of black people from the neighborhood, not just young adults and potential members, but all kinds of, older people and, kids and, just a whole range of people, hundreds of people turning out for these street rallies, and many of them bringing their own guns. So this just really changes the dynamic, where it's no longer sort of a few individual Panthers patrolling the police around, but now all of a sudden you have hundreds of people in a community that's only, I think, 3,000, if I'm remembering correctly. It's not a very big community, but you have hundreds of people turning out for these rallies and bringing their own guns and rallying armed on the street corners and basically rejecting the legitimacy of the police. And so all of a sudden this is a very serious political issue. So the state assemblyman Mulford steps in and moves to change the law and take away the, and he's a Republican and has support from Governor Reagan and a number of other elected representatives to basically restrict the right to bear arms upon which the Panthers have organized these early armed patrols. And then what the party does is it sends a delegation right into the state capitol. And so that here you have armed Panthers legally bearing arms going into the state capitol. And at this point, the delegation, I think, is about 30, so it's a little bit bigger group. And a lot of the people are drawn, actually, from the Richmond protest to challenge, this law that's being put forward to basically restrict the right to bear arms, because they've been able to use this right to actually be quite effective at political mobilization. And this becomes a national story. So this is where a lot of people first hear about the Black Panther Party. And here you have, people who are not just talking about black power, but are actually standing up against police brutality in an effective way. And this really starts to capture people's imagination across the country, who are thinking, well, how do we build black power? How do we create something like the civil rights movement? So this is the first sort of leap to another level of recognition. And then part of what's happening, there's a few months there where things are, you know, up and down, there's an important turning point. It's not clear exactly how the party is going to sort of move forward after the Mulford Act passes, because they can't organize armed patrols anymore, right? For the basic sort of practice that's built some stature in California, they're not able to take it to the next level, even within California, because California restricts the right to bear arms. So they have to sort of reinvent themselves. And Huey Newton does a lot of important theoretical writing in this period, and really sort of envisions the Black Panther Party in the way that I had talked about, as this sort of representative, legitimate representative of the black community, and it's, you know, part of this global struggle, international struggle against imperialism, and he has a key insight, which really revolves around armed self-defense and the challenge of the police, and it's got you know, two sides to it, right? The one side is that he really is recognizing the armed rebellions, not just the Watts Rebellion, but the whole series of rebellions that have been developing through this period, as a signal of where people are at, and at sort of the willingness of many young black people on the streets to stand up against police brutality, to stand up armed. And he has this idea that he wants to organize that and turn it into a political force. And what he says is that he says, you know, look, we need to be able to deliver a consequence. And if we can arm people and people defend themselves, then that provides a consequence. It makes a source of power. So we need to get guns into people's hands, and we need to create an armed challenge as a basis of sort of building political power and a political movement. Now, that's at this point in, you know, the sort of summer of 67 and into the fall, that's just an idea. Mm-hmm. But what happens is that Huey Newton ends up being pulled over by a policeman in the middle of the night, a policeman with a record of brutality, a policeman who's actively looking for Panther cars in Oakland, and there's a confrontation and some debate on what exactly happens. The court proceedings are less than definitive in giving us a clear picture of what exactly happened, but Officer Fry ends up dead and shot and dead, I believe with a police officer's gun. And Huey Newton ends up with a bullet wound in the abdomen. Mm-hmm. And this confrontation becomes the sort of focal point. This is in October of 67. It becomes the focal point for the Black Panthers' Free Huey movement. Mm-hmm. And Free Huey campaign. And really sort of materializes and represents in a very practical kind of way this idea that Huey Newton has been propounding of standing up armed self-defense against the police. Mm-hmm. And Eldridge Cleaver at this point has become a key leader of this local Black Panther Party, and he really organizes broad support around this campaign from two key camps. One is that he brings SNCC at this point is really looking and trying to figure out how do we build black power. Mm-hmm. And doesn't really have an answer to that. They have, you know, they're very famous, and they, you know, have, you know, are recognized as having, you know, done a lot of the dismantling of Jim Crow, but they don't really know how to move beyond that, and they're looking for solutions. So they sort of jump on this Free Huey campaign and explore a merger with the Black Panther Party and organize these gigantic rallies in both Oakland and Los Angeles to Free Huey. And then the other piece is the Peace and Freedom Party and some of the sort of white new left and anti growing, you know, burgeoning anti draft movement, which also teams up for its own set of reasons, and the Black Panther Party has really positioned itself to take advantage of those potential allies. So bringing in strong support from both the anti-war New Left and then also sort of the leadership of SNCC, the Black Panther Party really is able to catapult this Free Huey campaign onto a national stage and get very wide recognition as a model of how to build black power. And that's that really starts to come together by February of 68. What shifts the scale of things is when Martin Luther King is killed. And, you know, by April of 68, people who are active trying to organize black power across the country have mostly heard of the Black Panther Party, and they've heard of the Free Huey campaign, and they sort of recognize this as a model for how you build power, but there's still some holding back. King is still, you know, he's talking to the younger generation as well and trying to make the bridge, and he's saying, we can do this through nonviolence. You know, if you stick with me, we can figure this out, and we can, you know, we can fight poverty, and we can, you know. And what happens is when King is killed, assassinated, it really, for many people, it's sort of the closure of that possibility of you know the civil rights nonviolent movement being able to take the next step and address poverty and the hope that people had held I think is significantly diminished and many people turn to the Black Panther Party as the model for how to organize a significant political challenge. And so it's really in those last 6 months of 68 that the Black Panther Party becomes a national organization, spreading very, very quickly to well over 20 cities with, you know, dozens, in some cases hundreds, and eventually in some cases, you know, thousands of young black people in cities, you know, in each city, joining, you know, dedicating their lives to the Black Panther Party. The other real key wave is actually in 69. And what happens is that, you know, early on, but especially in 68, as the party starts to grow, the party becomes the target of pretty heavily, you know, heavy and brutal repressive efforts by the government, local police, but working with the federal government in a coordinated effort to repress the party, and people see that and respond, and that drives some of the party support. But what happens in 69 is that the party really shifts gears in part in response to repression and highlights and focuses and starts to really center its activities on you know, a piece that it had theorized early on but really developed only in 69, which is the community programs. And in starting in January 69, the Free Breakfast for Children program becomes in many ways the central activity of the party. And here, you know, the federal government has this war on poverty, and but you have starving black children and non-black children in cities throughout the country who can't get a decent breakfast. And here you have the Black Panther Party with, you know, no resources, organizing and feeding thousands of children. And this really becomes a central activity of the party and really drives also a lot of the continued growth. Combination of armed self-defense, anti-imperialist program, and community programs taking care of the black community.
Right. Now let's just quickly juxtapose the federal government's response to the breakfast program as opposed to the Black Panther Party, because I was shocked when I read in your book that the government only spent, was it $600,000 on their breakfast program versus the Black Panther Party with very limited resources feeding thousands and thousands of kids, right?
Yeah, I mean, the federal government didn't have much of a breakfast program, you know, at that time. And so this was, you know, this was something that the party, you know, the party was talking to people and recognized, you know, that people were hungry and this was something that needed to be addressed. And so they, you know, they really pioneered it. And, it, you know, I haven't done a systematic analysis, but it's, you know, the correlation seemed to work out, and a number of people have claimed that a lot of the growth of the federal breakfast programs were actually in response to the Black Panther Party's breakfast program. You see that very clearly in programs like the later sickle cell anemia testing, where the party really pioneered those programs that were then taken up much, much more widely on a social basis. By the government.
Okay. Now, how did the Oakland chapter manage all of these new? Because at this point, the party is expanding to a lot of new cities, right?
Right.
So how did they manage all, you know, the different? Because you have chapters all over the place. So how? Because at this point, Huey Newton's in prison, right? And is Bobby's in 69? So Bobby Seale is he in prison also?
Bobby is not in prison until August of 69. Okay. I mean, he spends a little time after the Sacramento action, and then is out through 68. You know, he gets out in late 67, and then is out through 68, and until August of 69. The question is, how does the Oakland organization manage this national growth?
Yeah, because it's just so, you know, you got so many new people, so many new departments. It's just, I know David Hilliard was pretty instrumental in that.
It's an excellent question. And, I mean, one thing that I want to make clear, and this is important for organizers to understand, you know, perhaps especially, right, is that, you know, we have this idea of movements being built by the hard work of organizers knocking on doors and carrying their clipboard and, you know, pleading with people and getting them to come and building the organization. Certainly there's a lot of that happens in most organizations and many movements, and those are key pieces. That hard work of organizing, of, you know, building organization, you know, that's a key part of any movement. But there's something else that happens here that really makes this a movement and makes it different from those other organizations that all also have people doing that hard work of talking to folks, networking, organizing. The party really captures a moment. They are able to create a set of practices that has tremendous power because at once it's disruptive. You can't, the state, the federal government cannot tolerate young Black people arming themselves and standing up to the police and having armed confrontations with police. I mean, you look at the history, and we go into a lot of the particular incidents. You know, it's quite disruptive and threatening to the status quo to have these armed confrontations happening around the country between young Blacks and police. Most of them not, by the way, organized or directed by the party in any direct way, but in the way that Huey Newton theorized. You put guns in the hands of people and people defend themselves, and you're going to have a consequence, right? So this is quite threatening, but it's threatening in a way that's hard to repress, specifically because there's so many people who support the basic claims and ideas that Black people ought to be able to have some self-governance, they ought to be able to have some sovereignty, basically, you know, and that they, you know, it's not whether people, you know, whether organizations like the NAACP and the Urban League support the party, or whether, you know, the parents of draft resistors support the party per se, you know, they probably, many of them don't, but they also don't think that young Black people who are organizing some kind of politics to represent their interests and stand up to police brutality and try to address the widespread exclusion, that they shouldn't be brutalized, they shouldn't be killed. And so what happens in this period period is that the party grows on its own. Mm-hmm. You know, is that they're able, the party is able to tap, it's able to seize the time, it's able to tap the power of the political environment in a way that they're able to both be disruptive, but do so in a way that draws broad support against repression. And what happens is that people see that. Mm-hmm. People see that, right? So the party, when it spreads, it's not like the party is sending, you know, ambassadors to these different cities and trying to say, hey, you should be a Black Panther too. No, people are writing the party and they're saying, I want to be a part of that. I want to join. How do I join the Black Panther Party? And they're calling and they're writing letters constantly. So the party is inundated in 1968. It's inundated with people who see Huey Newton stand and the Free Huey program and the politics that the party has created and the armed self-defense. They see this as a vehicle, as a channel, as an effective means to build power, to address the police brutality and the political and economic exclusion that they're facing in their own community. So you have all these people pouring in without any real sort of organizational cohesion or framework. They're all coming to the table, and so Oakland is left in quite a challenging situation. First, with Bobby really at the reins until August of 69, and then it's David Hilliard who's the main person in charge for the next year until August of 70 when Huey Newton comes out. And they're faced with quite a challenging situation of how do we really build some cohesion in this movement. And so it's an interesting mix. On the one hand, you know, there's a fair amount of independence among these local chapters. There's some really quite striking differences. You look at, you know, the New York chapter, for example, with strong roots in Garveyism, and people look at people's names or the way they dress, mm-hmm. And they're wearing dashikis and taking African names, right? Versus, you know, a chapter, you know, like Los Angeles, where there's such a strong sort of oppositional stance in relation to the US organization and cultural nationalism, right? So there's really quite distinct politics on the ground in these local chapters, and yet the party is trying to advance a revolutionary movement, a revolutionary vision, and is trying to steward and shepherd these alliances that have proven so crucial in standing up against repression and in bringing in resources to run the organization and its programs and to defend the you know, members of the organization in court. The Oakland National Headquarters has quite its hands full in how to manage this, and you know it's a combination of things that they do. I mean, they do make there's a group of officers and ministers and leaders from the national organization that do travel around the country and work with people and try to get their programs on board. There's a sort of unified voice in the Black Panther newspaper that puts out the party line and tries to build sort of a cohesion message, a cohesive message and vision of what the party is doing. And as things get complicated, especially with the repression and with some of the infiltrators from the FBI and Asian provocateurs, but also just some of the different things that the party members are doing, the party also starts purging people who step outside of the line of the you know, the revolutionary vision as understood and managed by the national organization. So those are some of the ways that the party is able to sort of manage its national growth, and it restricts membership at one point. Bobby Seale in early 69 puts a freeze, and then they only very selectively let new chapters open in. I think it's in July they create the the NCCFs and give sort of provisional status to people who want to create a chapter under that NCCF umbrella, National Committee to Combat Fascism, which is a sort of an umbrella organization under the Black Panther Party, and let, you know, young activists sort of start provisional chapters pending formal approval as a full chapter.
Now, what makes Huey Newton call everyone to Oakland? That was a big transformation, right?
I'm sorry, what was that?
Yeah, there was one point in your book where Huey Newton basically calls all party members to Oakland, right?
Yeah, I mean that's in 72, and de facto by that point the party has basically fallen apart.
Okay.
And you know, has many of the chapters have been closed, and the party has stopped, not only stopped growing, but has really started to return to being basically a local organization again. So Huey Newton formalizes that in 72 with the program of Oakland as a base of operations. But if you look at it, you know, some people have claimed that was sort of, you know, very much a programmatic change only. But if you look at the Black Panther newspaper, for example, and look at coverage of activities of the local chapters around the country in the period leading up to that decision, or you look at coverage in the mainstream press, or, you know, there's not that much going on. Things are starting to very much unravel, and the organization is very much in decline.
Okay.
And so that's really the way I see it, is a formalization of that shift and a recognition that the party is losing influence and significance on a national level, and an attempt to take the resources that there are and consolidate them in order to try to do something significant on the ground in Oakland.
I see. Okay. Last question. You did community organizing before you wrote this book. That's sort of what brought you to writing the book. What do you think are the important lessons for organizers now, based on your research?
I think the key sort of insight that I've gotten from studying this history, I mean, I really, you know, I had two kinds of things that drove me to this history from my organizing work. And you know, what I had come to recognize was that, you know, sometimes you would be, you know, doing the work and doing what had worked in a different time and place, and it would just be completely ineffective.
Mm-hmm.
Can you hold on one second, please?
Absolutely.
I'm sorry. Sorry about that.
I'm okay.
So I think that there are times, you know, anybody who has worked as an organizer and has participated in activism has the experience of being in a march, and you get the people out, and you know, you have a turnout and you're doing the march, and it ends up feeling like you're chanting to yourself.
Yeah.
And you know, you're doing what worked somewhere else and what you've seen work, but nothing's really happening that seems significant. You know, you maybe even turn people out, but then, you know, nobody's listening, and you go home, and you know, it's sort of like this. So what? You know, and you know, it's not clear how to get traction. Other times, you know, you'll be doing something, and you know, things will start to gel, and all of a sudden, there's this moment, and things just come together. And all of a sudden, you're really moving people. The authorities that you're engaging and challenging have to come to the table, and there's power. And things sort of click, and there's a mesh between what you're doing and the context. And so I really wanted to make sense of that. And, you know, the party really provides an important way to get into that question, specifically because of the contrast with civil rights and because it's such a different kind of politics. And what I think the sort of generalizable lessons are that have been so stark for me in really studying this history is that what I think was very similar in a very different way, what was very similar to the civil rights movement was that the party found ways of tapping that power of disruption, of, you know, people have a certain amount of institutionalized power. I mean, we have our relationships, we have our institutional position, we have our, you know, assets, we have our prestige, we have the things that we have, and you know, if you're facing a certain form of oppression, you know, you're going to use those institutionalized sources of power that you have. And but what happens is that the institutions tend to reproduce themselves, and they reproduce themselves in particular in the interests of people who are in charge of those institutions. And so, you know, you saw that in the period of the late 60s, right? You had the dismantling of Jim Crow, but you weren't getting redress of ghettoization. Right. You know, it wasn't like, you know, you look at the Atlantic City Convention in 64, Democratic Convention, and the Democratic Party has been a key ally of the Civil Rights Movement, basically tells the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, who's all these leaders from the Civil Rights Organization who are supposedly their, you know, key allies, forget it. We're going to seat the all-white, you know, Democratic Party. We're not gonna move on this because this isn't about formal segregation, right? We're gonna make sure that there are institutionally ways for you to vote, but we're not gonna work with you beyond where you've succeeded in really challenging formal segregation. We're not gonna take that next step. And so what the party does is it finds a new way to make business as usual impossible through this politics of armed self-defense. And so I think that's the first lesson, right? Is that if people want to really build a movement, right? There's development work to do, and I think that's important work, right? Mm-hmm. And so doing the networking, doing the door knocking with the clipboards, doing the organization building, there's important work to be done there, and I think that you know, that for people who want to do that kind of work, there's always that kind of work to be done, and it's just about, you know, it's in many ways about the grind, and that's you know, and it isn't so rare. You know, there's plenty of organizations that are trying to address issues, that are doing the networking, that are doing the, you know, turnout, that are, you know, building the relationships, and that's important. But there was something different that happened with the Black Panther Party in the same way that there was something different that happened with the Civil Rights Movement. And I think that what they did was they tapped the power of disruption. Yeah. They made business as usual impossible. And there's a kind of power that comes from disruption that creates new sources of power. It's not institutionalized power. It's a power that comes out of getting in the way of institutions as they're established. And when you see that sweep across the country of the Black Panther Party, you see that sweep really building on the power of disruption. You see people seeing a new source of power, a new way of changing and challenging their conditions that they don't have access to through the institutions that they're a part of. In the same way that people saw the Freedom Rides as a new source of power, the same way that people saw the sit-ins. Oh, look, these college students can go and they can violate Jim Crow and they can get away with it. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to do that too, right? And so that's the first lesson, is that there's a kind of power and a kind of mobilization that comes out of building on that power that really can spread when so that's the first piece. And the other piece is about what makes that sustainable. And in many ways, you know, different in its particularities, but similar in its generalities, the Black Panther Party was able to make disruption sustainable by developing a set of practices which was able to draw broad support in the face of repression. So that's true of the Civil Rights Movement as well, right? If you look at the Civil Rights Movement, if the sit-in activists had been lynched and killed, right, or jailed without recourse, and nobody had come to support them, then not a lot of other people would have jumped on that bandwagon. But what happened was that in the moment, those claims for full participation in citizenship rights, nonviolent civil disobedience against Jim Crow, were very hard to repress because there were lots of people who were going to turn out and support them. And the same thing happens with the Black Panther Party. It's different constituencies, different practices. But if armed self-defense and a revolutionary politics was just going to get the party killed and there was not going to be any support, then the party would not have lasted very long at all, and it wouldn't have had much influence. But what happened was, first, because it was legal in the way they organized the armed patrols, and then because it was diffuse and because it wasn't orchestrated and it created de facto disruption through these actual armed confrontations, but in a way that the party as an organization was basically advancing the idea of Black community power and self-control, and doing so in a way that also challenged the very, you know, illegitimate Vietnam War in ways that made ties with, you know, Latino and Asian American efforts to organize some power for immigrant communities in ways that put itself as part of. They were also able to attract very broad allied support, and especially important within the Black community, because there weren't, you know, while there was maybe 45% of young Blacks in polls said that they supported the revolutionary politics of the party, it's not like most Black people were running out to join the Black Panther Party, but the political organizations at that time were not having their basic issues addressed. They were not getting access to electoral representation. They were not getting access to municipal hiring, police departments, fire departments. They were not getting access to elite higher education. There was a very small and contained Black middle class. So there were large Black political organizations, much more moderate, that while they didn't necessarily support the party's politics in a way that they wanted to participate in it, they also didn't want to see the young Black Panther activists, you know, assassinated and killed in their beds as they were being by the federal government. And so this was a politics that was able to draw broad support in that moment. Mm-hmm. Against repression at the same time that it was very disruptive. And I think that those are the two key lessons here, that movements come out of doing those two things, that when there's a match between the practice and the context such that the activist can advance a transformative program in a way that really taps that power of disruption, but does so in a way that can be sustained by drawing broad allied support, then you get a movement.
Josh, thanks so much for spending time and talking with us. We took up a lot of your time. but this was great, though. Thank you so much. What are you working on next? What's your next project?
My next book is a comparative study of actually these three movements in the post-war years of Black freedom struggle, and trying to much more explicitly make those theoretical arguments that we were just talking about how movements work, and using the comparative contrast to get at those political dynamics.
That sounds exciting. Josh, thank you so much. I want to thank you for coming on New Books with African American Studies and speaking with us. And I'll send you a link as soon as we post the interview. Guests, thank you so much. Guys, thank you so much for listening. And I hope you enjoy it.
Well, Josh, thank you, Sean. It's been my pleasure.